Hello and welcome to another episode of CultureDigitally.org. This is Hector Postigo from Temple University, co-founder of CultureDigitally.org, along with Tarleton Gillespie at Cornell University. Today we have a special episode of our podcast. This episode is a recording of a recent talk that two of our guest contributors gave at Temple University. It was sponsored both by the Temple University School of Media and Communication, the Department of Media Studies and Production, and by CultureDigitally.org, so it was nice to have that collaboration. The first speaker is Brooke Duffy. She's an assistant professor in Temple University's Department of Advertising at the School of Media and Communication. She studies the changing nature of cultural production in an era of digital and social media. She is the author of Remake, Remodel, Women's Magazines in the Digital Age from University of Illinois Press, which is forthcoming in the fall of 2013. Our second speaker is Alice Marwick. She's an assistant professor of communication and media studies at Fordham University and an academic affiliate at the Center for Law and Information Policy at Fordham Law School. Her work investigates online identity and consumer culture through lenses of privacy, surveillance, consumption, and celebrity. Her first book, Status Update, Celebrity and Attention in Social Media, is forthcoming from Yale University Press in 2013 and is based on a multi-year ethnography of the San Francisco tech scene. Along with their presentations, you're going to also have available in the text associated with this podcast a recent dialogue that Alice and Brooke engaged over email to sort of try and flesh out the various interesting commentary and discussion that ensued following their joint presentations. So enjoy the podcast and enjoy reading the associated dialogue, and we look forward to your comments and suggestions. Thanks very much.
I guess a week or so ago, I came across an article in the book review column of The New Republic, and it suggested that the chick lit heroines of the late 20th century, so Carrie Bradshaw, Andy Sachs, and Becky Bloomwood, have been replaced by this new generation of new media mavens. And now the 21st century protagonist that the author was talking about, she said, these people do not work in traditional media industries, so they're not penning a column for a weekly newspaper, nor are they working in a fashion magazine, taking directions from this Prada-wearing devil. Instead, they come from the blogosphere. And so the author of the article, Molly Fisher, explained something in kind of an interesting way. She said, where chick lit once tantalized readers with romance or fancy clothes, the vicarious thrills of its new media incarnation are more mundane and more rooted in the actual mechanics of doing a job. And so it's right here at this nexus of new media, professionalization, and constructions of identity that I situate my presentation today. And so I want to do a few things. First, I just want to tease out some themes related to fashion blogging and see how fashion bloggers construct their own identities. I want to use this information then to go on and challenge some of the identity myths that we have about bloggers, including the idea that they're authentic, that they're expressing themselves, that they're community orienting. And finally, I want to use this information to delve into larger themes related to how we think about media industries in the early 21st century. And again, this is part of my larger interest in studying the changing nature of cultural production, and specifically, what are these contested spaces around media professionalization? And let me also say that this is a new study, so I really do welcome your feedback and encourage any advice you have, or encourage you to give advice. So let me give you a little bit of context in case you've never seen a fashion blog before. The first fashion blogs appeared on the scene maybe about a decade ago, and were largely these indie style musings, very low readerships. And since then, fashion blogging has absolutely exploded, and I think we can think of it as a unique culture and practice of cultural production. And it involves individuals, typically females, who produce and distribute fashion and style-related images, information, personal commentary. And there's a huge range of fashion blogs. So they range from these high runway recaps into street style photography, so going out on the sidewalk and taking pictures of clothing you think are particularly stylish, to more niche blogs, which focus on things like DIY style or plus size fashions. And what tends to happen is that these fashion blogs get grouped together and situated in discussions such as this. So fashion blogs are said to democratize fashion, or they represent a new era of influencers who are coming in and changing the guard. Or fashion blogs allow regular Janes like you and me to become part of the international fashion conversation. And these narratives all came from recent trade press reports. And so you may notice that these narratives here tend to fit neatly into larger discourses we hear about digital media. So the idea that the consumer is empowered. And this is often attributed to this expansion of low-cost media production distribution technologies. Again, the idea that you guys can create your own content. There's no longer these top-down hierarchies of information. And certainly these kind of ideas are not just applied to fashion blogs. I mean, we hear this in the commercial sector. We hear it in terms of video games, news, films, and so forth. And so against this backdrop, we also tend to hear about fashion bloggers changing other sites of cultural production. So fashion bloggers are impacting the magazine industry. Fashion bloggers are impacting the fashion industry. And this seems to signal what Aaron Myers described as an intervention into traditional media hierarchies. And so we have these stories of bloggers who take the place of traditional media magazine editors. So they're invited to go to Fashion Week. They get these lavish freebies. They have exclusive interviews with fashion celebrities. I think maybe 2 years ago, Tumblr invited a bunch of bloggers and put them up in this fancy hotel. And there are some blogs that have readerships that do rival the top magazines. And some such high traffic has enabled some of the most famed blogger names like Scott Shulman, Garant Story, and Tavi Gevinson to translate their fashion blog fame into the book, magazine, and art industries. And mainstream media have really tended to situate bloggers and traditional media producers against each other in this kind of war. And what this essentially done has just amplified the tension between, again, the traditional producers and this digital flood of amateur producers. Now, the fashion industry has more of a symbiotic relationship with bloggers, and I'm going to play this quick clip to give you a sense of some of the narratives that I'm going to be talking about today.
So much attention, the Brian Boys, the Susie Bubbles, the Tavis of the world, that's because they're saying things in a different way that people find authentic and very personal to those individuals.
A blog doesn't cost anything, so a reader can have several different favorite blogs. You don't have to have one or two magazines that you go and buy a month, but you just go and click on the ones that you like, which is good.
Personally, I think there's actually room for bloggers and stylists and fashion editors and writers alike. I don't think, you know, I don't think that it should be such a cliquey, closed environment. I think it's absolutely fine, and there's definitely room for everybody.
We get the news out faster, so people do kind of look to us to see what the trends are, what people are wearing.
Everyone's putting stuff on straight away. You can be more creative, you've got no restrictions or boundaries.
They give a more personal approach to fashion, you know, when they post, you know, pictures of themselves wearing designer clothes or, you know, outfits. It's really approachable compared to what they see in magazines.
I feel like they're adding a real dose of reality and freshness into the fashion world online.
They've given a lot of limelight to people that otherwise wouldn't have been seen as much, and a lot of editors who are fantastic dressers that no one knew about now are fantastic, and they're leading fashion and they're influencing designers, and that's amazing.
The editors and the styles and the buyers are wearing designer clothes, right? So to see them wear it in their own way is a little bit more inspiring.
There's a lot of creative energy and output that you don't get from print journalism. And I think that's actually changing things at the level of design.
I just think they're making a bigger landscape. I think street style blogs are the ones that have really taken off because they're the ones that are in control of all the visual elements, the writing. I mean, it's one visual consistent element.
We can see there how these overlapping narratives, they come together and they situate fashion blogging in this distinct moment that is defined by destabilized hierarchies. Again, democratic communication. And what I want to argue today is these narratives are actually limited and limiting, and that they fail to address the nuances, the nuanced cultures, the nuanced political economies of fashion bloggers. And so that's what I want to do today. I really want to look into this. What is the idea of a fashion blogger? What are the affordances and limitations of identifying oneself as a fashion blogger? How do fashion bloggers construct their identities as individuals, as content creators? I mean, this is what they're doing. They're creating. And finally, as community members. And finally, you know, the big question of this, how can we use such answers to understand something about emergent forms of online activity, particularly within a context that is highly gendered and highly commercialized? And so those are my research questions, and what did I do to kind of answer these? Well, I looked specifically at the Independent Fashion Bloggers Network. Is anyone on here by chance? Fred is. And so this is a resource. It started in 2007. It boasts itself as the largest community for fashion bloggers. It has about 50,000 members, but those estimates may be a little off. And what I did was use the Independent Fashion Bloggers website, did an analysis of some of the commentary on this, and I looked at about 200 posts and 1,000 comments. They were published over a 7-year period. In addition, I also turned to the trade and mainstream presses to understand how fashion bloggers are being talked about from the outside. So there we have the inside and the outside perspective. And finally, I also rely on some interviews I conducted as part of a separate project. And so I was able to talk to some current fashion bloggers that have now entered into the magazine industry. And so what emerges from this data is this fragmented, multidimensional, and very nuanced and even contradictory category of fashion bloggers. And I think that we can find these fashion bloggers as held together through a series of what I call identity myths. And so this includes the authenticity myth, or the idea that these are just regular people like me. The autonomy myth, or this conception that blogging is an individual creative activity that exists apart from the commercial context. And finally, the egality myth, the idea that this is a very democratic social space. It's community oriented. And these myths, I want to argue, contradict some of the actual discourses and practices taking place among fashion bloggers, and possibly conceal the very real ways in which fashion bloggers are very much like traditional sites of production that they try to distinguish themselves from. And so I'm going to spend the rest of the time today going through and unpacking some of these myths, but I want to be very clear at the outset that I break these apart for analytic reasons, and so there's certainly a lot of overlap and intersecting. So we'll start with authenticity. Fashion bloggers, like other progeny of the Web 2.0 era, often claim to be authentic, and Alice, our follow-up speaker, has done some really great work on this, and so she'll be touching on that, but I'm focusing really on this idea of real people being integrated into commercial production. And there's really been an interest in this lately, you know, not just in an online space, but also in advertising campaigns and even reality TV. I mean, that's, you know, a decade and a half old. But that was the enduring success of this is often attributed to this idea that it's authentic. So Mark Andreevich has said that, you know, viewers watch real people and feel as though that could be me. So there's this larger interest in authenticity. And so there's a number of ways that authenticity is constructing in fashion blogs. And as I mentioned, Alice is maybe talking about more of the relationship between authenticity and commercialism. What I really want to focus on is this idea that bloggers are authentic and that they are ordinary people who are non-experts. They're not professionals. And so this is a comment from one of the bloggers. She said, you know, PR people try to take advantage of this, of us. But we're not professional journalists. We're regular people with a passion for fashion. And so this real people narrative was frequently deployed throughout the site, and in some cases it was used to establish a sense of credibility. So in a post titled Power to the Bloggers, We're Changing Fashion's Visual Culture, this woman, Georgina, was talking about how she turns to fashion blogs for something she can't get from other sites. She says she trusts them more. And here's a quote. It's fantastic if bloggers are helping women feel better about fashion. For me, it's also about hearing what a, quote, real person thinks about clothing. A styled model might look great in a dress I'm looking at, but it's unlikely she'll be able to tell me about the service delivery or whether the seams come undone after 10 minutes of wear. But I get that from bloggers. And so here we can see how bloggers are thought to have a sense of expertise that's not rooted in a profession, but rather from their ordinary lived experience. Sammy Davis, meanwhile, who incidentally is a Temple grad who graduated from the journalism program, I guess about 4 years ago, she used this idea of authenticity to distance fashion bloggers from traditional sources of information. Davis said she believed that, quote, more and more women are turning to personal blogs for fashion information and turning away from the big .coms of magazines, magazine websites. And then she told me she felt a key limitation of women's magazines industries is they, quote, can't say things everyone can relate to. On the other hand, the strength of fashion blogs is the idea that they are, quote, 100% authentic. Now, despite these appeals to authenticity, I think there's this contradictory logic emerging that relates to distinctions in capital, social and economic capital. And so, you know, theoretically, anyone can go out and start a blog, but there are resources you need to have in order to maintain this. You know, the most fundamental is internet access. And I think, you know, we may take this for granted, but a recent study by Pew American Internet Life suggested, you know, 20% of adults don't have regular internet access. So that's the baseline. Beyond this, fashion bloggers often talk about some of the tools and equipment they need and describe these as an investment, investing in your future. And so they turn to the IFB website for advice on cameras, tripods, even remotes, personalization, software, editing, and so much more. And one post even suggested that to become a successful blogger, quote, you have to follow the mantra, you have to spend money to make money. And I came across another article that suggested just to get a start in blogging, they broke it down by cost, and it's $1,300. That was their idea. And so that's the other resource you need. And, you know, there's an idea that bloggers need some kind of clothing, some kind of style they can base their commentary on. But I want to qualify this because there's a lot of street-style bloggers who are going out and taking pictures of real scenes. They don't obviously need to have the means to clothing. But I think most importantly, in order to be a fashion blogger, you need to have a leisure time. I mean, this takes a lot of work. And from crafting the styles to actually taking the photos, perhaps editing them, arranging them, writing the comment, it's a time commitment and a luxury that perhaps not everyone can afford. And so in this sense, I would argue that blogging represents conspicuous leisure, you know, showing off your time, but maybe more than that, what Lynn Spiegel calls conspicuous production. And this is the idea that today in the digital home, in the post-industrial home, individuals show their status by showing that they can work anywhere from inside the home. So showing their technologies, this is how we mark status. And so this leads me to believe that fashion blogging is both gendered and classed. In addition to having economic resources, I also want to challenge this idea that bloggers are ordinary people. A lot of them actually suggest on the sites that they have some kind of unique skill set. So aside from those who actually learn a living as professional bloggers, and I'll return to that, many noted how they were professional journalists, writers, designers, PR specialists, and so on. And so these individuals are not necessarily just regular people, but those that have an intimate connection to the advertising, fashion, and marketing industries. Closely related to this authenticity myth is this idea of autonomy, or the idea that blogging is a creative form that exists apart from any kind of economic resources. And this is something that's talked a lot about in, if you're familiar with media production literature, you know, this tension between creativity on one side and institutional constraints on the other. And David Hesmanhall explains how media work today requires a negotiation of the creativity commerce dialectics that are at the heart of modern cultural production. And so often there's things on the site that refer to creativity for creativity's sake, and that creativity should always win out in the battle versus commerce. And for instance, Vonnie from Grit and Glamour wrote, "Blogging is not about numbers and comments and popularity. It's about creative expression. That's why you started your blog, remember? It wasn't for everyone. The site is and was for you." And similarly, IFB members expressed gratitude for blogging because it gave them a chance to discover their true selves, their inner selves, by focusing on things like writing, photography, even curation. And so I think this is a good example of how this narrative plays out. This is Marissa, and her blog is called New Dress a Day, and so her idea was to spend $365 on 365 dresses over 365 days. And she was explaining why she started blogging, and here's her response. "I was inspired to start my blog last summer after a screening of Julia and Julia. I had gotten laid off and was ready to turn 30 and was in a creative funk. I left the movie and was jealous that Julie Powell, the character in the movie, had found something to get her creative juices flowing on a daily basis, and I knew I needed to do something too. I'm not a chef, but I've always enjoyed refashioning clothing." And she says, "You know, I knew this would be a challenge, but beneficial, more beneficial than I imagined." And so in this case, again, we see that blogging is not meant to project something to the outside world, but it's a way to discover your true self. At the same time, though, the idea of creativity was tempered by these discussions of how to make money on the site. And I mentioned at the beginning that the IFB site has really gone through a transformation. It's much more focused on, you know, how to earn money from blogging rather than the community aspect. And so now if you look through the site, they have forums on branding, business tips, Google, monetization, and so on. And these pictures, and most of them from the slideshow, are taken right from the site to show the kind of articles they include. And so this really, you know, emphasizes the notion of doing what you love and getting paid to do what you love. And there certainly are some bloggers that have, but that's the exception, not the rule. So the question then is, how do bloggers reconcile, in one sense, this idea of inner self-discovery and, you know, the external need for recognition? One way they balance this tension between creativity and commerce is by suggesting that if you have a truly individual blog, the external recognition will come. So here, blogger Ash Mischief is talking about how her blog evolved in recent years, and she said, "I think continually about my voice as a blogger, making my site authentic and true to me. If anything, I think about next growing steps will be a push forward, stronger, to make the site more personal, more me. It's interesting, though," she adds, "because I find that after personal content growth spurts where I push myself, other aspects of my blog change as well. My rankings improve, my community grows." And this picture caption, I don't know if you can see it, it's the same kind of narrative. It will be your individuality expertly expressed through a well-done blog that gets you to the top of the heap. And so in both of these cases, it's the same idea. Again, if you work hard, discover your inner self, you'll get rewarded externally. And this really seems to suggest that creativity is not necessarily an end in itself, rather a means to an end. And this mention of top of the heap brings me to the third myth, egality. So over the last decade or so, the internet has been hailed as this great equalizing force. It gives everyone a voice and seems to destabilize media structures. And blogs in particular are thought to be this community space, this virtual community space. And so here's a quote from a blogger discussing what she called the fashion democracy. She said, "It's the belief that any girl with wit, personal style, and a camera can inform us about what is fashionable. Everyone can have a voice." And, you know, this idea of the voice. Someone else said, "Bloggers are the voice of a common man or woman." And I thought it was interesting they said man or woman. It turns out it's a male blogger. So here we see this idea, and probably one of the most emblematic quotes about this is someone said, you know, "Blogs are the most democratic spaces on the internet." This democratization narrative, we also can find an extension of this through the emphasis on blogging as a communal activity. And bloggers are often sought to provide a community space where people provide guidance, advice, nurturing, even friendship. And so one recent article was called The Joys of Blogging, suggested that community was at the top of the list. According to Lauren, I doubt there are many bloggers who would argue against community topping the five things about blogging list. The community of bloggers is something that often shocks newcomers. They weren't prepared for the comments, the forums, the friendships, and more. Similarly, when the blog first started, another person posted, I appreciate a community where my worth isn't judged by my traffic. And finally, another quote that suggests, this community space is a way to challenge top-down media. As Anne says, lauded as independent voices, blogs in fact exist within a highly interactive community, and it's the connectivity that differentiates us from traditional media. And so again, this emphasizes that the blogging community is an open one that privileges the community over the individual. And so I don't want to dismiss the socialization, the community aspects of blogs, but I also want to suggest that there is a significant hierarchy that seems to structure them. And so on the IFB discourse, I kept finding terms like this, professionals, mega popular, highly successful, top tier bloggers, mid-range bloggers. And a lot of these boil down into traditional metrics. How many followers you have, whether you're making money. So IFB actually defined what a mid-range blogger is and said, here's how you know if you're a mid-range blogger. You have an Alexa traffic rating of between 30,000 and 100,000. You have at least 3,000 followers on Twitter. The important one, the blogger is monetizing through brand projects and you post consistently about 3 to 7 times a week. And so we can see here this very defined hierarchy in the blogger community that seems to be bound up with a marketing logic. And this points to another kind of tension in the blogs, the idea that there is a marketing logic. Blogging tends to focus on self-promotion, building one's brand. And Alison Hearn describes this as producing cultural value and potentially material profit. And so we find these two very contradictory ideas. You know, the idea of establishing oneself as a brand on one sense, and at the same time, you know, this fits quite uneasily with this idea of community. And so what can we conclude from this? Well, taken together, it seems that these narratives circulating about fashion bloggers, both inside and outside the community, don't necessarily map onto bloggers' actual practices. And the themes of authenticity, democratization, and autonomy that they draw on conceal the fact that they're embedded in the same institutional structures as the magazine industry and other traditional fields. Indeed, the emergent logic of bloggers seems to be increasingly market-driven, hierarchical, and self-promotional. And so given the disparity between blogger myths and some of the realities I highlighted, I argue that the category of bloggers is a problematic one, or at least one that needs to be sufficiently nuanced. And let me just say that, you know, because of this shift, there's definitely been some backlash in the blogger community. So I came across this, which is kind of hard to read, but it's fashion blog requirements. Pictures of really skinny girls, overpriced clothes and shoes that no normal person can afford, and shirts and crap. And so this is really calling out the fact that bloggers claim to be authentic, claim to be autonomous, but there's really this shift to commercialization. And, you know, one other commenter wrote, it drives me crazy that bloggers start off trying to convince viewers that they're just like them. Once they start gaining a following, a large one, start attracting the sponsors, they begin to wear expensive shoes, clothes, and handbags that people can't afford. Did anyone forget that we're in the economic downturn? Let's skip over that. So where does this leave us? Well, I argue that we can use the case of fashion blogging to push back against these recent claims that we should rethink traditional media industries in light of new economies and technologies of media. I disagree that media industries are being transformed and reconfigured by the integration of consumers. Rather, it seems that these bottom-up consumer practices are actually being reconfigured to be more like media work. So in theorizing media labor, I think a more productive suggestion is to turn attention to the ways in which these emergent forms of online content creation promise flexibility and individualism while retaining structures that are quite characteristic of work and culture industries. And so the challenges and opportunities confronting bloggers, drawing audiences to get advertisers, focusing on self and promotional branding, emphasizing creativity versus constraint and how to balance this tension, this is something we often hear about. In the end, fashion blogging seemingly brings together the practices and structures of old media with heightened forms of self-expression, entrepreneurship, and post-feminist affective labor that scholars like Alison Hearn, Melissa Gregg, and Alice Marwick, who's going to be talking with you in a few minutes, have come to associate with the age of social media. And so it's in this very context that we can return to the 21st century chiclet heroines from the blogosphere and understand why Molly Fisher describes that they have a new romance. It's not romantic love, it's not passion, but rather the romance of work.
My name is Alice Marwick. I'm an assistant professor at Fordham University, and I'm really interested in the dynamics of how social media changes how people think about themselves and how they think about other people. And today I'm going to present kind of a mishmash. This is basically a theme that runs through two studies. I've never presented these together before, so we'll see how successful this actually is. But I'm going to be focusing on micro-celebrity, which is this concept that I've been working on for a couple of years. So this is traditional celebrity. This is the lovely Kim Kardashian. And even Kim herself, as popular as she is, I think in some ways represents a shift in celebrity, and one that's fairly recent. Kim tweets a lot. She's on a reality show. She has sort of a connection with her audience that's a little bit different from like the movie stars of days of yore. But celebrity has always been inextricably linked to media. Without media, nobody can be known beyond a local area. So when we think of celebrity, we're usually thinking of broadcast media, like movie stars, television stars, etc. So it only goes to show that as our media changes to social media, the types of celebrities we have will change as well. And thus, with a shift to social media, celebrity changes. So this is sort of how scholars would describe celebrity as sort of multiple things. It's a genre of representation. It's a discourse. It's a way of thinking about people and bodies. It's a commodity. You can think about the industries that produce celebrities. And it's a cultural formation. This is Graham Turner, who's a scholar of celebrities. And yes, you too could be a scholar of celebrity. That could be your actual job. But instead of thinking about celebrity as a genre or a discourse or an economy, I want to think about celebrity as a subjectivity, as a way of thinking about yourself, and as a way of practicing. Celebrity, rather than being something that people are, as something that people do. So celebrity as a practice. Now, at the same time, American culture has sort of undergone this process of celebrification, where celebrities have become more and more important to many different aspects of American culture. So we see celebrities in politics, in business, in food, in all these different areas now we have celebrities. And although the historical emulation of celebrities is nothing new, I mean, you can look at the turn of the century, the early film industry, people emulating like Clara Bow's lipstick, that kind of thing. The way that fame works has become much more visible to us. And so Brooke just mentioned movies like The Devil Wears Prada. There's also reality shows like on The Hills, Lauren Conrad interned at Teen Vogue. There's a sort of a fascination with the inner workings of the entertainment industry. This from American Idol to sort of these movies, you see all these different processes of how celebrities are constructed. And celebrities themselves build into this, right? Like they tweet about what they're doing and they show the process of them doing like PR shoots and all these types of things. So we now understand the inner workings of how celebrity functions much more than we did before. Paparazzi, photo opportunities, casting, all this stuff. It used to be a little bit more behind the scenes, and now it's really very central to how we understand celebrity. So in this context, I want us to think about micro-celebrity, and micro-celebrity being a set of practices, of things that people do. And a bit about this is a self-presentation strategy. It's really about thinking about yourself, but also thinking about the people who are watching you. It's not necessarily about the number of people who are watching you, but how you think about that. So I've seen people who literally have like 15 blog readers or have like 100 followers on Twitter, like really think of themselves as a celebrity and act like they're a celebrity. So it's not necessarily about the number of your audience. It's really about the way that you think about yourself and the way that you think about other people. You're presenting yourself as a celebrity regardless if anyone's paying attention or not. So a couple of things about my current projects. As I said, this is kind of a mishmash of two. The first project, which is the new project, which is the one that I'm more excited about because it's newer and fresher to me, is about fashion blogging. And I am really looking at sort of, I guess you would call them quote unquote average fashion bloggers. I've been interviewing fashion bloggers in different American cities. I've interviewed fashion bloggers in Nashville, in the Raleigh-Durham area, North Carolina, in Washington, D.C., and in Boston. And very few of these bloggers are people who are making a living off their blog. Instead, they're sort of just like average girls who are putting up pictures of themselves, sometimes which are taken with cell phones, not necessarily that high quality. But they all think of themselves as fashion bloggers. They go to fashion blogger meetups. They connect with other fashion bloggers. As Brooke said, there's something like 40,000 people who identify as fashion bloggers, and not all of them are the people who are getting like a million unique hits, you know, a month. And so I've been interviewing these bloggers. I've gone to some fashion blogger events that have been put on by the Independent Fashion Blogger Association, etc. And then my other project is my book called Status Update, and it's about how people in the San Francisco tech scene think about status and what they do in social media to boost their own status and popularity online. And this involved moving to San Francisco and living in San Francisco from 2008 to 2009 and spending a lot of time with people who worked at companies like Dig and Twitter and Foursquare and really interviewing them about their practices and about the status hierarchy in the community that they were living. And what I found out in this community was that I could see sort of three different strategies that people used to try to make themselves more popular online. And all of these strategies used techniques that had been drawn from marketing, advertising, commercial discourses, celebrity, for people to increase their own popularity, which are self-branding, live streaming, and micro-celebrity. And so I'm going to focus on micro-celebrity today. Now, these two communities are quite different. The tech industry tends to be very male-dominated. It tends to have a very masculine ethos. It tends to really privilege male ways of thinking and male ways of being. The fashion blogger community is overwhelmingly women, but it also has a very very overly feminine kind of feel for it. There's a lot of emphasis on like cupcakes and puppies and Audrey Hepburn and things like that. But there are some things that they do have in common. The first is that they're both highly wired. As Brooke said, you have to have a certain level of comfort and access to technology to be a successful fashion blogger. And people in the tech scene in San Francisco are probably the most wired people in the entire country. They are online all the time. They all have smartphones, tablets, everything. These are people who are living their lives online and offline without really seeing a split between the two. They see the internet as just kind of a continuation of their regular everyday life. They also both have micro-celebrities. They recognize that their scene has micro-celebrities. They talk about them. They're impressed by them. They discuss them, and they were very willing to talk about them with me. So here's a couple of examples. Both of these were mentioned in the last presentation. That's Brian Boy and Tavi Gevinson at a fashion show. And over here we have Michael Arrington, who runs this tech blog called TechCrunch. Julia Allison, who's a New York media personality and one of my case studies in my book. I'm kind of like sickly fascinated with this woman. And then Perez Hilton, who's a gossip columnist that you're probably all familiar with. And these are all people who are promoting themselves online. They're creating a persona. They're performing that online. They're reaching out to people who are paying attention to them like they're a group of fans. And it's really about looking for attention and visibility, like trying to make yourself more visible, trying to get more people to pay attention. So this is my formal scholarly definition of micro-celebrity. It's a self-presentation strategy that includes creating a persona, sharing personal information about oneself, performing intimate connections to create the illusion of friendship or closeness. So not really necessarily creating friendship or closeness, but acting as if the people reading you are your friends. Acknowledging an audience and thinking of them as fans or constructing them as fans, and using strategic reveal of information to increase or maintain this audience. Social media technologies are an intrinsic part of this process. All right, so this is a big dump of text. So now I'm actually going to go through the different parts of these and talk about what they mean in practice for both the Web 2.0 community and the community of fashion bloggers. And often it's about adopting the strategies of celebrity culture and adapting them using social media. So here is an example of creating a persona. This is Julia Allison, and this is her life cast. And I would say 90% of her life cast is pictures of her in dresses. posing in different dresses in different contexts. Like, here's the green dress, here's the blue dress, that kind of thing. And she is very into this sort of like affective tie to the audience. Like, she'll be very open about like the breakups that she's going through and that she's really sad, or, you know, what she's doing. She puts a lot of photographs and videos up, and she really treats the people who read her blog like they're a fan club. And this last summer, she was on a reality TV on Bravo called Misadvised. But she had this online persona for years and years, and the online persona was really what got her the reality show and not the other way around. So she already had this sort of relationship with people who are paying attention. And she's a whole other thing, because she has this group of people online who absolutely can't stand her, and they blog about her all the time. So she's sort of a good example of someone who's hated more than they're loved. But here's an example of a micro-celebrity who's trying to appeal to their audience. This is Adam Jackson. When I interviewed him, he was 21, and he had just moved to San Francisco to seek his fortune. Like, he wanted to be the next Steve Jobs. And he, at the time I interviewed him, he had what for the time was a lot of Twitter followers, like 5,000. He said, "There's a reason why I can post 150 times a day and still have 2,000 followers. People seem really interested in what I am saying. I get more replies than most of the tech experts because my things are very, they make you want to stick to them and reply. I happen to have a knack for it, I guess. I spent a year and a half changing the way I tweet on a monthly basis to find that algorithm of success." So he had actually emulated really popular tech celebrities in the field and sort of created his tweets in such a way that they were going to get him the most attention. I love this idea of the algorithm of success. And he had this whole theory that if he got enough Twitter followers and enough people knew who he was, when he came up with an idea for a startup, someone would fund it. He didn't have any ideas for a startup, but if he did have an idea, he would be able to get funding for it. He was actually a really nice guy. But this is a good example, I think, of that strategic inculcation of an audience. All right, so I want to focus most of my presentation today on authenticity, because it's my current obsession. And also, obviously, something that came up in Brooke's presentation. The nice thing about meeting someone who works on the same thing that you do and who's come up with a lot of the same ideas that you have is it shows you that your ideas are correct, which is great. And this idea of authenticity, as Brooke showed, comes up time and time again when people are talking about what makes a good fashion blog or what makes a fashion blogger distinct from traditional media. But it also comes up in tech a lot. For people who are bloggers or people who are tech personalities, there's this idea that you have to follow your passion and be true to yourself. And if you're an entrepreneur, you really have to be authentic and different. And so in both of the communities that I studied, even though they were really different, I saw these discourses of authenticity as being super, super present and super important. Although people did define authenticity differently in these different communities, they still agreed of its importance. So here's Kiara from Blonde Salad. She's one of the super high-end, super famous fashion bloggers. And she spoke at the IFB conference in 2011. And she said, "The most important thing for bloggers, first of all, is to be true to their followers and be true to yourselves. We are bloggers, not artists, but almost." They are almost artists. And here she's really trying to contrast fashion bloggers with fashion editors and the fashion press. And the assumption here is that the fashion press does stuff because they're paid for it. But fashion bloggers, instead, you're doing it because you're being true to yourself, you're being honest, you promote a product because you really like it, you wear an outfit because it expresses some kind of internal sense of self. There's a real tension here between being authentic and being fake. And people police this tension in a lot of different ways. They really will say this person's a sellout or this person has crossed a line where they really are being fake. They're no longer authentic. But the interesting thing here is, just as Brooke found, authenticity is often just put out there as a way that you can differentiate yourself from other bloggers and thus make more money. So rather than it being something where you are literally being true to yourself, you're trying to portray an authentic self so that you'll get a lot of people reading you, so that brands will sponsor you, so that you will get profit, which, you know, a little contradictory there. All right, this is one of my interviewees, Allie of Wardrobe Oxygen. And she said, "I think the blogs that really last and will last through everything are the ones where you know the person. So if they gain weight, they have a kid, they lose their job and they can't afford their designer clothes anymore, you still love them because you know them as a person." And this is the idea of authenticity as being honesty and giving you glimpses into people's inner life. One of the nice things that happened while I was working on this project was that one of the women I interviewed, she and I had a discussion about authenticity. And she ran this like Friday Five kind of thing where she would put up five questions and different bloggers would answer them, which was called Fashion Beauty Friends Friday. And after our interview, she turned around and she asked her followers 5 questions about authenticity. And 93 bloggers answered it. So I had this like fantastic data set that I had to do exactly no work in putting together, which is great. So I have all these like great definitions of authenticity from all these different bloggers. And a lot of them talked about how the difference between a blog and a magazine is a blog, you get glimpses into somebody's life. And partly I think people are just interested in how other people live their life. Like, it's a very human impulse for us to want to connect with others and see how people's lives are similar and different from yours. But partly I think it's to provide a context for them reviewing products or them showing off outfits. Like, you understand the kind of person they are, so you understand the way that they're dressing in a different context than you would a fashion magazine. But this authenticity also has a downside. Here's Julia, and she says, I'm honest, I can't get away with anything. If I get hair extensions, I have to say it. Otherwise, I get called out for it. Every negative point I have to be honest about, and it's brutal. On the other hand, ostensibly, I'm doing what I love for a living. Now, Julia, you know, nobody cares if Jennifer Aniston gets hair extensions or Jennifer Aniston gets Botox. Nobody would ever expect her to reveal this to her audience. But the norms of internet culture and the norms of tech culture are quite different from the norms of traditional celebrity culture. And while celebrity culture has a sense of separation and artifice, there's really a sense of authenticity when it comes to these, you know, internet celebrities. And so people, her haters basically will call out like, oh, she got Restylane or she got lip fillers or whatever it is. And then she's like, oh, I have to tell people this or they get all angry. But the point is that she's trying to work within these different norms. Like, she's kind of an appearance-oriented person. So in some ways, she is adhering to the norms of traditional celebrity. But because her fame is basically located online, she's called out for being fake because she's not adhering to the norms, the authenticness of internet celebrity. The second thing I want to talk about is the relationship between the audience and the blogger, or the audience and the micro-celebrity, and how that indicates more authenticity. So traditionally, as I said, the relationship between celebrity and fans is one of distance. Like, you're not going to meet Brad Pitt. You're not going to get an email from him. I guess you could write his fan club or, you know, buy Tea and Beat or something with a picture of him in it, although they would not do that because he's old. But the idea here is that there's a push-pull between fans really wanting intimacy, right? And celebrities having, like, managers and publicists and people who are kind of brokering their access to those celebrities. I think this is actually like the Jonas Brothers arriving at like MTV or something like that. but micro-celebrities don't have this distance. And they're presumed to be more authentic because they are accessible, because you can reach out and email with them or, you know, get to know parts of their life that traditional celebrities wouldn't reveal. This is a blogger who's actually quoted in Brooke's presentation from Grit and Glamour. And she's talking about what makes a blog authentic. And she says, frequent interactions with readers establishes authenticity better than anything else. When you write back to readers or visit their blogs, you share your voice and perspective even more informally. And readers can see that you actually care, that you're a real human being. That's huge to me. So many of us adore celebrities and designers, but because we rarely interact with them on a personal level, sometimes they don't seem real. It's the human interaction that creates connectedness. Without it, we are simply photos on a page or worse, talking heads. So she's very explicitly contrasting bloggers who reach out to their audience and talk to people and answer comments with traditional celebrities and designers who don't. And saying that people like bloggers more because they have that connection that they can't have with like a Karl Lagerfeld or an Anna Wintour. And here's an example. This is Carmen. She's a vintage blogger from Nashville, and she goes through every single one of her comments and she replies personally. So here this person's like, oh, I love this 90s duster. And then she writes, which you can't say, oh, I also like love the 90s duster. And this is really a sense of accessibility. And in this sense, there's not a gatekeeper between the two, like a editorial assistant or a manager. Instead, there's like this kind of direct access. All right, the third aspect of authenticity that we see is that fashion bloggers and micro-celebrities in general reveal aspects of popular culture that the mainstream can't or won't cover. And so this is Gabby Fresh. Her blog used to be called Young, Fat, and Fabulous, and now it's something more, I don't know, now I think it's just called Gabby Fresh, but she's a fat positive fashion blogger, of which there are quite a few. And there's a lot of different niches that focus on fashion. Fat positive bloggers and women of size, women of color, modest fashion bloggers who like cover up their elbows and their knees, petite fashion bloggers, queer fashion bloggers, transgender fashion bloggers, butch lesbian fashion bloggers, like all of these different niches that you do not see addressed at all in mainstream fashion. Partly because mainstream fashion just is you know, it has a certain like body normativity and whatnot, but also partly because these are small subcultures well, most of them aren't, but a few of them are. And there's enough blogs that they can address them. But this sense, I think there is something to this sense, because these are communities that are pretty large and they're not being addressed by mainstream fashion media. And the sense here is that anyone should be able to participate in fashion, that you don't have to look like a skinny model to be able to have the pleasure of fashion and sort of self-expression through clothing. But also here, they'll talk about fashion bloggers are real women and they don't look like the models in magazines and yada, yada, yada. However, I will say that the fashion blogs that provide like truly transgressive perspectives on fashion, like there's one called Lipstick Eater that's a transgender man and he wears men's clothes and women's clothes and mixes of them, and it's a very cool blog, but it's very transgressive. These are not the ones that are getting front row seats, right? These are not the ones that are getting the big brand endorsements. Generally, the bloggers who become very financially successful due to their affiliation with brands are the ones who kind of look like models to begin with, or who are at least like tall and skinny, right? So there's a sort of limit to how transgressive these can be if you assume that they're being validated by being picked up by mainstream brands. Okay, quite similarly here is sort of the fourth way that people define authenticity, which is authentic style. And here people say, the kids who put everything together from Goodwill and Salvation Army and look awesome are the kids that inspire me. It's not the ones that have money that are able to look at style.com and, you know, put together the entire thing that's been shown to them. And because I was mostly interviewing these kind of like average fashion bloggers, a lot of the time they would speak quite like negatively about the luxury bloggers who are wearing like head to toe super expensive clothes, like Jane Aldridge of Sea of Shoes, who's 17 and whose mother said in an interview that she spends $75,000 a year on her daughter's clothes. Like $75,000 a year on clothes for a 17-year-old, which is kind of crazy. But there's this idea that there's a sort of uniqueness and authenticity from this like fresh, vintage, or thrifty perspective. And these are examples of bloggers who are sort of have this kind of uniqueness, but as you can see, they're both very conventionally attractive in a very kind of model-y looking way. What counts as authentic often is quite predictable. It's just about a tall, thin woman putting on, you know, a different set of clothes than the models. All right, I'm kind of running a little behind. So I want to talk about engagement with brands because I think it's really important. If you look at some of the discourse around authenticity that scholars have written about, a lot of the time they'll talk about like authentic street art versus street art that has been paid for by Pepsi, right? Like the kind of Naomi Klein no logo stuff where you say that what's authentic is what has been unsullied by commerce. Or the idea of like you want to go to Chicago and you want to go to an authentic blues club. You don't want to go to the touristy one that's just set up for money. And so in a sense, some people think that to be authentic, you have to kind of be a little bit removed from commodity culture, that you can't be buying or selling anything. But this doesn't exist at all in the fashion blogging community or really in the tech scene, because they're both so intrinsically interlinked with commodities and with commercialism to begin with. So this is Elle and Blair Fowler, who are some of the best known online YouTube stars who deal with beauty products and fashion. This is their Forever 21 haul video. And a haul video is when girls come back from shopping and they show everything they bought to their webcam. And some of these videos have like 500,000 views. I watched a haul video that was 7 minutes long and it was about a single box of chocolates. And they get really into this stuff. But as Brooke said, fashion bloggers are recognized as this gigantic force for word-of-mouth marketing, and they're really powerful. So tons and tons of marketers are trying to reach out to them and are giving them free clothes and free goods and free bags, and they're trying to get them to promote them because these bloggers are seen as more authentic, their word counts for more than a fashion magazine because people presume that fashion magazines are paid for the goods that they show, which they are. So here's an example. I stopped reading certain blogs because every single outfit was courtesy of. And courtesy of is what bloggers say when they get something from a brand. So I'll say jacket courtesy of J. Crew or something. It went from having a little bit of an authentic voice to just being marketing copy. I consume blogging because it is not traditional media. And I feel that I can tune out some of the messages that, if I were watching TV, would just be in my face constantly. So the idea here is that brand engagement really should be honest. That it's okay to talk about brands, but you really have to be affiliating yourself with brands that, first of all, you actually like. And second of all, if you're promoting a beauty product or whatnot, you should have actually tried it out and seen if you like it or not. And that, there's a there's a lot of like very complicated discourses around brand engagement, which I can talk about in the Q&A if anyone is interested. So a couple of findings that I can elaborate on again in the Q&A. And the first one is problematizing this idea of there being an authentic that we're comparing fashion bloggers to. This is a quote from David Grazian, who wrote a book called Blue Chicago about Chicago blues clubs, which is what I was referencing. And he says that authenticity is always manufactured in contradistinction to something else, which means that when we're thinking about things that are authentic, we're really contrasting them with things that we think are inauthentic. When you actually boil it down, there's really no quality that anything has that makes it authentic or inauthentic. It's really just a way that we have of categorizing things, but it's not like you can say like, oh, this club is inauthentic because it charges a larger cover fee than the other. These things don't really hold water when it comes down to it. And in this case, it's, you know, in the case of these bloggers, a lot of it is like, you know, an authentic outfit that you put together because you like it versus an outfit that a mainstream media magazine put together because they were paid for it. Or thrift store fashion is more authentic than expensive style.com fashion. But in reality, authenticity itself is sort of a moving target, and it's really hard to pin down whether or not anything is actually, quote unquote, authentic compared to something else. The second thing, and this is something that really, I would say, applies more to my tech study than my fashion blogger study, is this idea that once you put yourself out there, you really have to monitor what it is that you say. And in the tech world, people get a lot of blowback for saying stuff online. They get a lot of criticism. This is Tara Hunt, who, she is very public. She lived a very public life. She dated this dude, and they had a very public, like, romantic life online. And when they broke, and they got called Web 2.0's Brad and Angelina by the San Francisco Bay Guardian. And she says, being a public figure is different. I have to date differently and be way more. You can't be that sort of carefree person I was before. I had to always sort of be a little bit more careful about who I date and how I date and all that type of stuff. So there's this enormous tension between trying to be authentic and honest and transparent, but also maintain a sense of privacy and not put stuff out there that's going to make you negatively judged by other people. And so this is where the communities, I would say, diverge a little bit, because in the tech community, you really have the sense that you're presenting an edited self to other people. And this is from Glenda Bautista, who's another one of my interviewees. And she says, your online identity is being developed by people around you. It kind of touches on the point where I say it's not really within your control. You constantly have to police yourself. You have to police other people, police your friends, nag them to take photos down. It's exhausting. So while social media supposedly allows people to present a more authentic self, it actually is just a performance of authenticity, and it's actually one that has to be quite carefully monitored, which is a lot of work. It's a lot of labor that people have to do. I also want to talk very briefly about engagement with commodities, because as I said, it's not about fashion bloggers not engaging about commodities. It's about there being a very specific set of rules about what types of engagement with commodities are appropriate within the fashion blogging world. And I think a lot of this is being quote-unquote transparent and honest about who's buying and selling whatnot. But as you saw with Brooke's presentation, you know, the top-tier fashion bloggers, there is a great deal of commercial interaction. So sometimes these lines are quite difficult. And authenticity, I think, boils down to more about a set of effective relations between bloggers and their audience and these commodity goods and these products and the way that people feel about them than it is about any one specific practice or any one specific thing. I also, so just to close, we see micro-celebrity practice in a lot of other communities as well. Zeynep Tufekci is doing a study on activists, micro-celebrity activists. Our own Hector Prestigo is talking about video game bloggers and YouTube communities and things like that. The word was coined by Teresa Senft in her study of cam girls, and I've also seen it in my studies with Dana Boyd of teenagers. And although micro-celebrity manifests slightly differently in all these different communities, I think it's a really significant online practice because I think it is sort of the ultimate culmination of a bunch of social threads. The popularity of social media, our overall sort of obsession with fame and publicity, the sort of quote-unquote American dream of being authentic and following your passion, and also entrepreneurialism, especially in a downturned economy. There's this idea that you can harness social media to build your own brand and create your own business and sort of be somewhat independent from the commercial world. But in reality, these practices are very difficult to make money off. And they end up being a lot of work, and they often have quite a few difficult emotional downsides for the people who engage in them. So I just want to urge us all to think quite critically about the role of social media in our lives and in other people's lives and in what really it can be used for versus what it should be used for. Thank you.